Welcome to the Journey to Midwifery podcast. This podcast platform is for midwives to tell their story. This is where you get to hear the how and the why a person is called on this journey to midwifery. I'm your host, Amber Wilson, a midwife myself, and I came up with this idea so that all those people asking these questions had a place to go to find answers. I hope you enjoy these stories as much as I enjoy recording them. Okay, welcome to another episode of Journey to Midwifery podcast. And this week I am super duper excited to have Rachel Reed, who so kindly met me bright and early in the morning in Australia, to share her story and what she's doing now. So hi, Rachel. Thank you.
Hello. Thank you for the invite. This is going to be interesting.
Yes, because you, unlike a lot of the people I have on, you have your own podcast. So you're like an expert at this, right?
Well, Katie does the expert. I just turn up and talk. So I can talk. I can't do any of the technical stuff.
And tell us what your podcast is called.
It's called The Midwife's Cauldron because it's just literally a hubble bubble of us talking about midwifery, breastfeeding, womanhood, anything that pops up, really.
Yeah, I'm sure that it's a blast. So we're going to just start from the beginning of your story. Why, what made you want to become a midwife?
Okay, so when I was a kid, obviously I didn't know what a midwife was when I was a kid, but you know, I was very much used to hang out with the boys because I wasn't very interested in dolls and all that kind of business. But I used to, when the girls were having their babies, so you know, to have their dolls up there, tops, and then they'd give birth. Well, I'd go over and kind of help them give birth by catching the babies, and they'd drop a stone. I don't know why we came up with this, but they'd drop a stone out of their skirt, and that was a contraction. So we obviously knew about contractions. So I'd be counting the contractions, which would be stones, and then the baby would come out, and then I'd get back on my bike and disappear off. So I guess I was playing midwife without knowing what a midwife was.
Yeah.
And then I got cat in my teenage years. I was a bit, I was a teenager, you know, probably horrible and difficult to be around. And I got interested in feminism. So I was kind of reading things like Naomi Wolf at that time. And so I got interested in kind of feminist stuff. And I actually got pregnant when I was 18, so pretty young. Left school with not many, well, no qualifications really. And got really interested in what was happening to my body and what was going on with growing this baby. So I just started to learn. You know, I was never interested in learning at school because it's all boring. All of a sudden, this is really interesting. So I learned about what's happening to my body. That birth experience was kind of, you know, interesting. So this is in England, and reflected on that and kind of came out of the birth experience going out, actually, goodness me, there's these midwives who are really, who this is all they do, is they, you know, look after women who are having babies and this amazingly fascinating thing that I've just done. And it's pretty kind of feminist and kind of from a quite a socially, it's kind of more like in the community part of, yeah, I was also interested in sociology and things. So I thought, wow, I want to be a midwife. And then looked into it. But at the time, obviously, I now got a baby. I'm 18. My partner at the time, husband now, was still doing his art degree. So we were pretty stuck where we were. And I was doing work that you can do with a baby, which was office work. So the only place that I could train to be a midwife would be not in my hometown, which was where we were living. So it would have meant moving everybody. And also, I didn't have the qualifications. You know, I'd left school with pretty much nothing but a baby. So I started studying sociology. I actually did the Open University, I can't remember what it was called, but it was basically sociology. And that was back in the day, that was like really unusual because there wasn't internet online stuff. This is back in, before the 2000s, so early 1990s. So you'd get books through the post. And you'd write your essay and you'd send it off in the post. So I did that. I passed, didn't get great marks, but I actually passed. So I was doing that while, you know, mothering this baby. And then I had another, and then I actually gave up on it, being a midwife, because I thought I can't move everybody into another town just for me to do midwifery. So I gave up on the idea. And for some reason, so I was working in an office at that time doing desktop publishing. And for some reason, I thought I should join the police. I have no idea where that came from.
That's out of nowhere.
I think it was probably because I didn't want to work in an office. I was doing that because it fitted in with having kids. So now I had two kids. I couldn't really see a, I'd just given up on the midwifery thing because the only way I could see to do was to move or study to be a nurse first and then do a postgrad. And I knew I didn't want to be a nurse. I couldn't be a nurse. It was not something I could do. I have no idea why the police came up. I think I thought, oh, this is a good job. If you get in, then you've kind of got a job for life. It's pretty well paid. I'll be good. It's working in the community. Anyway, I didn't get in because I passed the physical and I didn't pass the interview. so luckily they didn't want me. And what they do is they give you six, you're not allowed to apply for another 6 months. So when you do the interview I don't know whether it's the same in the UK, nobody gets in the first time. You do the interview and then they give you the information you need to get in the next time. So you get the things that you should have said. There's keywords that you meant to say that I didn't say. I think one of them was fighting crime, like a superhero. Didn't say that. So I didn't get in, but I got the keywords to get in the next time. And within that 6 months, I'd realized it wasn't a good idea. And a Bachelor of Midwifery program had actually opened up in our city. So I could study midwifery without now having to move.
Wow, that's so nice.
Yeah, so it actually worked out quite well, getting in the police force.
Yeah, and maybe that's why they do it. So everybody can be really sure they want to be in.
Yeah, and that's why I think it would have brought out the worst in me. You know, I think I would have enjoyed being a detective. I do like a bit of detective work, but I think the socialization and the police force would have probably turned me into something very different.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah.
So you started there. You got in. Yeah. No problems there.
Well, I thought there'd be a problem. So I run my life by just being a pessimist and it works for me. I just always assume the worst and always assume so if things going to go wrong and that things won't work and that I won't get into things, because then you're not disappointed. And if you do get in, then you really, you know, that's really great. So I kind of approached midwifery like that. And it was a really difficult process to get in. There was 30 places and there was 300 applicants or around about that.
Wow.
So I just assumed, well, I'm not going to get in first time around because, you know, I knew that lots of people applied, didn't get in, then had to reapply. And I only had that as a preference. Like I couldn't also then put down other universities to go to. So I applied for it was a Bachelor of Midwifery Honours at the University of Northumbria at Newcastle. So you had to do an honours, which I didn't really want to do because I didn't see the point in doing the additional honours part of it. So it was a four-year degree, because of the honours, but condensed into 3 years. So it was a pretty full-on course. So anyway, I applied and just assumed I wouldn't get in and got an interview. And the interview day was, you know, we did group work and we did one-on-one interviews. It was pretty full-on. I can remember because I actually bought a suit for that. I'd never had a suit in my life. So I bought a suit and felt really uncomfortable for the whole day.
Yeah.
And then we had to wait. And that is the worst 4 or 5 weeks of my life was waiting for that. I was just, you know, every morning, have I got in? And I actually got in. So I was like completely, you know, thrown by that. Because now I had a job, my kids were in school, I had to work out how I was going to do this degree that I'd now got into.
Because you can't work when you're in school like that.
It was way too intense. What you got was you got a bursary, which was not a lot, and then you got a huge student loan. But realistically, I'm trying to think if anybody did work. But, you know, you were studying and you're doing shifts and, you know, I had kids in school and my husband was working. I can't remember what he was doing at that point. So it would have just been pretty difficult to find a job that would fit in to that.
So you said they gave you a little bit of money and then the rest is student loans.
Yeah, there was some kind of bursary because it was for the National Health Service.
Okay. Yeah.
And then the rest was student loans. So, you know, we survived. We had no, just, you could survive.
Yeah.
But it was, yeah, ended up with a lot of debt at the end.
Yeah, I think we all do. Mm. Even here, it's big. I didn't know how your how it worked there in the UK as far as financing.
Now, I think it's changed since then. And I think, because I visited the UK a couple of years back, and I think it's changed in that the bursaries have gone. So now they're getting very different demographic because you have to have money really to kind mm-hmm. of to step in and study. Whereas the women who were studying alongside me, there was a few school leavers. So Katie, who I do the Midwives Cauldron with, she'd had a gap year, but she was fairly young. Most of us were kind of a bit older and had kids and would not have been able to study that if we hadn't had access to a bursary. Yeah.
Yeah. That's very interesting.
Mm.
Yeah. So you finished, and then what did you do after that?
So I finished in 2001, and then I got a job in the hospital that I'd actually mostly trained in. So our program was set up that you had a community placement that was kind of your, it was like a home. So you started there with your kind of midwife mother, who was the kind of midwife you were allocated to in the community. And you went out there first. So you really learned about caring for women in the community setting and seeing, you know, the much bigger picture than just the birth or the, you know, the bits that everybody considers midwives do. So we really got to know this group of women, and, you know, she really role modeled to me what it is to be a community midwife and to work with a group of women who knew her. Often she'd been the midwife for them when they were born. So it was just a lovely grounding, I guess, in traditional kind of midwifery in the UK. And then we were allowed to go into a hospital, and our hospital again was the same hospital we kept going. So we kept doing this flip into the hospital, back out into the community, into the hospital, back out into the community. And the hospital that I trained in was a big regional referral unit. So lots of births, kind of pretty, I mean, it was medicalized, but nothing like nowadays medicalization. You know, there was still normal vaginal births happening without intervention. So that's where I got a job when I qualified, actually applied there and got a job in that big regional referral hospital. And yeah, it was full on year. Nearly left. So part way in, I started on the high risk postnatal ward, which is possibly my least, you know, the placement that would least fit me. Mm-hmm. So we were caring for women who were high risk, and the special care in that hospital was really limited to real special care babies. So these were babies who needed, you know, nasal feeding and were fairly special care babies. In other hospitals would have been in special care, but it was great because they were with their mothers in the mm-hmm. ward. So we were caring, you know, for a whole 20 plus women. And it was just full on, you know, constant 12-hour shifts, with the added responsibility now that you weren't a student. And I actually managed that. I think it wasn't until I'd rotated into the birth suite that I went, this is a horrible mistake, and I'm giving myself 6 months and then I'm going, because it was just awful. You know, I got a mentor who on the birth suite who quite clearly, well, I don't think she just hated me. I think she just generally hated everybody, including her job, and was not at all kind of supportive. Just chucked my first shift on birth suite. So I'd qualified, I'd been on the postnatal ward for must have been at least 6 months, and then I'd rotated onto birth suite, and on my first shift I was given a woman who was having a 36 week prem labor and all the kind of medical intervention that was going on with that, and a woman who was being induced in another room. And I was like, oh, provide adequate care to either of these women. And, you know, so I was planning my escape, gave myself 6 months, and luckily by the 6 months I'd turned the corner and realized that, yeah, I could actually do this.
I think it's so interesting. You're not the obviously first person I've spoken to the UK that and midwifery there that you all do all like the nursing and the birth, the delivery, whatever, catching the baby. And we here have nurses that do the nursing care and then midwives that do more similar to just what a doctor would do. We do the birth part. I mean, we're part of the care in labor, but the at the bedside so often is the nurse, but you do all that in one role.
Yeah, well, it's a bit different because in the UK, it really midwifery was an autonomous profession. So historically you had kind of the midwives emerged from the wise women and carried on being the primary carers for women really until kind of the early 1900s when it started to shift, when women started to move into hospital, and it was separate from nursing. So, you know, a nurse wasn't a midwife, it was a very separate profession and an autonomous profession. And then medicine, same thing happened over here, but a little bit more effectively, I think. And then medicine kind of got together with nursing and brought midwifery into nursing in order to control midwifery. So there's that political thing going on in the UK, and it's over here as well, where midwives were kind of pulled in to be part of the medical system when they never had been. And in the UK, they maintained a lot of autonomy. So in the UK, every woman gets a named midwife in the community, which is the midwives I was working with. And as the midwife for that woman, you're responsible for her care. So you're the one who refers her to an obstetrician if needed. And even in a big regional referral hospital, you're the primary carer for the woman. You're responsible for her care. And if she needs any obstetric input, you refer her to the obstetrician. So you would go out and say, can you please review this woman because blah, blah, blah is happening. So it was a really collaborative approach, you know. So often obstetricians would not see a woman at all during a whole pregnancy, birth and postnatal period. And if they did need to, it was very much they were coming in to offer their skills and, you know, their professional input around something that was obstetric and high risk. And they really respected the midwives as having that knowledge around normal birth. So, you know, they'd ask, what do you think? It was just a very different approach. So nursing is very separate. So even midwives who did nurse training and then became a midwife would often then just be a midwife. So they wouldn't work in nursing as well. It was like a different identity. And then I came to Australia, and Australia is like a hybrid of the American system and the UK system. So it's a lot more obstetric involvement, and midwives are kind of seen as nurses. It's probably more similar to the US.
So in Australia, do they do all the labor management and birth the same in the UK, like in the hospital?
No, they have. So because in the UK, we've got the NHS, so you could birth wherever you wanted on the NHS. So for example, I have my second baby at home, and that was paid for by the NHS. NHS midwives came to the home. So it's all the same system. So it's not like hospital midwives and home birth midwives, it's midwives. And as a midwife, you have a duty of care to provide care to women regardless of where they're birthing. So if you're employed by a hospital, you'll work in the hospital. But at the same time, if there's a community midwife out in the community, or they have a shortage and they need somebody for home birth, you could get called out of the hospital to go and attend a home birth. So it's pretty much centered around where the woman's birthing, and the midwives provide that care. So as a community midwife in the UK, I would do home births, or I would do hospital births, depending on where the woman was going to birth. And it was all under the NHS. Over here in Australia, they do have home births. Most of them are private practice midwives doing the home births. Some of them have visiting rights, but it's a private agreement. And some of the hospitals have home birth services coming out of the hospitals. So there is home birth in Australia under the equivalent of the NHS, which is Medicare. And it comes kind of out of the hospitals, and it's very much controlled by the obstetricians in the hospitals around who can access that service and who gets risked out. So it's heavily controlled. Whereas in the UK, it was the woman's right to birth wherever she wanted, regardless of risk. So it kind of there wasn't a, you know, risk in, risk out, you could say to a woman, look, you're high risk for these reasons, and it's not recommended that you have your baby at home. But if she said, and some women did, I am having my baby at home, then you would go, okay, I will be there. Let's plan for that. Even in a high risk situation, it would be up to her. Whereas over here, it's, well, if you're a high risk, then you don't get the Medicare home birth. You know, you have to go and find yourself a private practice midwife.
What do you think you like better?
Oh, the NHS was much better, much clearer. For I found it a lot easier working in the NHS, because it was, women were taking responsibility for their decisions and mm-hmm. for their births. And it was very clear that my job wasn't about, you know, their decisions. My job was about providing adequate information and then making sure that whatever care I gave was the best I could in that situation, you know. Whether or not she's having triplets on a barge in the middle of a river or in a hospital, then, you know, you do what you can with what you've got. And that was the expectation. Whereas over here, I suddenly became implicated in decisions. You know, well, what are you saying to the woman, particularly as a private practice midwife? Why are you attending a woman at home who's having a high risk birth when you could say no to that? It's like, well, I've just been, you know, brought up to not say no, that it's not my birth, that if a woman has engaged my services and then her you know, pregnancy becomes high risk, then of course I'm going to recommend and I'm going to give her information around the risks. But if she insists that she's staying home, then I'm staying home with her, because I couldn't walk away from that, because I've been brought up as a midwife in the UK, which is a duty of care. I can't not, you know, I can't just dump a woman because she's not doing what I want her to do or what the hospital wants her to do. So it's just a very different, it just felt different. You felt more secure in the UK around supporting women making, you know, decisions that weren't looked on well by the hospital, because it wasn't your decision, it was hers. Whereas here, looking after a woman who's making decisions, it was like, well, I'm complicit in it all now. You know, why aren't you rejecting care of her? Why aren't you dumping her?
Yeah, I see how that's American. We'll just leave it at that. But I'm sure that, I'm sure UK midwives have things they have complaints about, but that's really just positive, having that patient autonomy, I think.
Yeah.
And patient choice.
It might have changed since I left, but, you know, the underpinnings of the kind of NHS and the duty of care idea hasn't changed. Access to a community midwife might have, you know, the NHS is on its knees, and with COVID, a woman saying, I'm having a home birth, she might be told, well, we haven't got the services to come out to you.
Right. Yeah.
Perhaps that's happening, but, you know, when I was out in the community, you would just get there. And if you didn't have a midwife in the community, you'd pull one in from the hospital to get there.
Yeah. So you all were very versed in both environments.
Yeah. So you didn't, once you qualified as a midwife, there was an expectation that you should be able to work in all areas of midwifery across to your full scope in any setting. That was, you know, you couldn't just say, I'm just going to work on birth suites. Like, well, no, you have to also work in the antenatal clinic. You also have to provide postnatal care. And if you're in the community, you do all of that as part of your job. And that's how I actually opted to go out into the community. I've been in the hospital, I think I'd done my grad year. So I'd done my time in the hospital setting. I actually really enjoyed birth suite. I particularly enjoyed teaching students in birth suite and having students, because that's another thing that was really inherent in being a midwife in the NHS, was that you just always had a student. It wasn't an option. You just were allocated students. It was just part of the job, just like looking after women in labor is part of the job, having students part of the job. So I did an additional course, you know, so that I could work with students and assess students and et cetera. And I really enjoyed that part of the job. And I actually really enjoyed birth suite. And although it was a big high risk unit, there was lots of really interesting things happening in terms of, you know, multiple births. We had, what's eight babies on all at once? Yeah.
Octo.
Yes.
Yeah. Something.
Yeah. So we had a woman, you know, come off a plane without having any antenatal care and
had eight babies?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Not all of them survived. I think five survived. So, you know, we had things like that happening. So there was a lot of really interesting cases happening because it was a big unit. But there was also this little, they called the kind of midwifery-led unit bit up at the end of the birth suite, which was like these lovely rooms that had birth pools in. And so I would often just work in there and do water birth. And I got involved in help developing the water birth implementation into that hospital. And so I was on the normal birth team, which was about promoting and supporting practices around normal birth. There was also the high risk team, which had a waiting list because everyone wanted to be in the high risk team. Nobody wanted to be in the normal birth team. So we were just a little team because they all liked the excitement of, you know, looking after women who were being specialed and all of that drama, which it didn't interest me. I might do that for a shift just to get an update, but, you know, I was much happier sitting in a dark room at the end of the corridor, out of the way of everything.
Me too.
And there was only one midwife in the room for a birth. It was lovely. You know, there wasn't this two midwife thing. So you could just go and hide and then come out later on and do your notes while make some tea and toast for the mama. And
so it's just notes. You and the mama and the partner in the room.
Yeah. Yep.
Wow. That's so
because there's a button. So if you needed anyone, you could press a button. Right. But yeah, there wasn't a two midwife rule in the room, which I don't know whether that's changed, but that was lovely. Sometimes you would go in, you know, if you had a friend and there was, or you wanted to, you know, or you had, if you had a student, there'd be two of you. But if, you know, you wanted to learn from, I used to have some midwives would come in because I would do like hands off, not doing things. So that was odd to some midwives that say, mm-hmm. Can I come in and say, if the woman's happy for you to be there for the birth, then that's fine. So you sometimes have other people in there, but.
When you went out to the community, was it just one midwife for a home birth?
No, you had two for a home birth. So when I went, then I went up into the community. And I really loved that. It was a really kind of challenging demographic. We worked a lot with social workers and drug support workers. And it was really interesting. This, and they were like an amazingly strong group of women. They knew what they wanted. And, you know, there was a lot of respect for the midwife, but at the same time, they were not scared to just say, this is what I'm doing. So I really enjoyed working with that group of women. We also had a lot of migrant women and non-English speaking women. And that was really interesting, like, you know, learning about all the different cultures and all the, you know, different perspectives. It was just really interesting. I really enjoyed that. And working with interpreters a lot. So I went into the community, did that, and then we decided to move to Australia. So I actually went back into the hospital 6 months before I moved out to Australia because they were scaling back the midwifery group practices that were out in the community for cost purposes. And so I put my hand up to go back into the hospital because, you know, I was going anyway. The other midwives weren't going to leave anyway. So I went back in and did, which was good because it got me back into that kind of hospital practice thing before I headed off to Australia.
And then did you work in Australia also as a midwife?
So it was funny because I came to Australia in 2004 and bachelor midwifery trained midwives were like, it was very, very new. So they didn't actually know what to do with me with my registration because midwives were registered as nurses. With midwifery qualifications. It's okay. Like, well, I'm not a nurse, so you can't put me on the register as a nurse. I'm a midwife. So that was a bit of a, what do we do with you? So I ended up getting a registration as a nurse saying midwife only on it.
Wow. Do they still do that?
No, there's two separate registers now.
Okay.
So there's the nursing and the midwifery, like in the UK. So mm-hmm. I'm just on the midwifery. I've got friends who are also nurses. They're on both registers. So it's two separate ones. Yeah. But at the time we were confused by me.
And then hospitals were confused. Yeah.
Well, I was confusing them. And then hospitals would, well, you know, didn't know what to do with me because they couldn't send me off into another part of the hospital.
Right. You know,
they couldn't just deploy me off somewhere else if they needed to. So yeah, it was a huge culture shock. You know, I'd come from the UK where here's me thinking I'm an autonomous midwifery practitioner and that I'm the leader you know, other than the woman who is the ultimate leader, but I'm the person who's, you know, leading the care, and that was not how it was. So I stepped on lots of toes accidentally. And private obstetrics was here. I'd never come across private obstetrics in the UK. You know, we were in the north of England, and that's not a thing. That was, nobody would be able to afford a private obstetrician. So that was a massive, some women pay obstetricians to do midwifery. This is really weird.
Why do you think they do that?
Because it's better, isn't it? You know,
you've got an obstetrician. That's what I was wondering.
But it's the culture is that, you know, they must be better at, which they are much better at surgery.
Is it still that thought process, you know, 16 years later, 17 years later?
Yeah, for a lot of women, it's, you know, it's who's your obstetrician, because midwifery has been very much suppressed in Australia. It's gaining some traction, but there's huge backlashes against it. So in the UK, the obstetricians and midwives, there's a little bit of fighting, but not really. You know, you're actually colleagues, and you guidelines are written by both. And, you know, the NICE guidelines in the UK are written by a panel. And there's just a lot more collegiality around, okay, well, you're the expert in normal, low risk, and you're the expert in high risk, and, you know, real difference. Whereas here, there's this real turf war, you know. So every time the midwives gain some traction, so the government, because of all the research about how beneficial you know, continuity of midwifery care is, the government keeps going, okay, we're going to roll out midwifery led care into the community. And then every time you get a backlash from the medical organizations. So the backlash of the medical organization is just the same as it was in the olden days when they said midwives were dirty and dangerous. They're saying exactly the same thing now, you know, we're dangerous.
Still today.
Like, the stats don't. Yeah. So I actually use that in teaching with students. We've got statements from the Australian College of Midwives, and then we've got statements from the Australian Medical Association. And we look at those and we compare them to historical, you know, the history. So it's still happening. So there's a lot of resistance here, and private practice midwives are getting pretty much regulated out of existence.
So how long did you, you're not still practicing in the hospital, are you? Am I wrong?
No. So I tried the hospitals in Australia. I think I lasted 4 years in hospitals in Australia and just couldn't. It was just exhausting. Constantly having to argue my case as to why I'm not doing a thing that's not evidence-based. So I decided to go into private practice midwife, into be a private practice midwife. And at the time it was like, no idea how to do this. So I had to work out where you get my equipment from. It's not like the NHS where you turn up and on your way to a home birth and somebody's already packed your kit and you pick it up from the hospital and take it, you know. You had to get your own kit. You had to work out your own paperwork. It was just totally new. And I just did that. And I did that by myself initially because I couldn't find anybody else to work with. And then slowly other midwives would come on board and we kind of made a lovely little community of independent, I call them independent midwives, because we transferred into hospital with women, but we didn't work in hospitals.
And you couldn't go with them for the birth.
You could, but you couldn't be the midwife.
Oh, okay.
So,
yeah.
You know, most women didn't transfer. But if they did transfer, then I'd be transferring into a hospital that I'd worked in, and I'd just take I'd just have a shift in role where I'm now supporting the woman more like a doula while which was fine for me because, you know, if it's a home birth, then it's all physiology, it's normal, and I can manage that. But if I'm going into hospital, I actually want the people who know how to use the drips and where the medications are, and because we've gone in for a reason. So I actually want the people who are good at the medicine to be doing that side of it, and I'll support the woman. So for a good few years I worked, you know, best part of a decade as a private practice midwife or independent midwife with I would work with another midwife, and it would depend on, you know, who that was, depending on what was happening in the home birth community. And it was lovely, and it was just amazing working for these women who had the resources to pay for a private practice midwife. So that's already, you know, not the same demographic I had in the UK, but these were women who had chosen to step outside the system. So they knew what they wanted. They were prepared to push boundaries, and they taught me so much about, you know, birth and how it can be, because, you know, we had no guidelines. We didn't have hospital guidelines. It was women saying, you know, this is how I'm doing it. And me going, okay, mm-hmm. let's do it that way then. So it was great. I loved that. And while I was doing that, I studied a postgraduate certificate in education. Don't know why. Just keep studying, I think, because I needed something outside of just outside of midwifery. I think I started that when I was working in hospitals and just going, oh my God, there's got to be something more than this. And then did enrolled into a PhD while I was doing private practice. So I did private practice and PhD alongside each other for years.
Wow. And mom. Mm. How'd you do all that?
Kind of older and...
Oh, well, still a mom.
I've got a very good husband who does most of the mothering.
Well, good.
So when they were little, he was kind of, he was pretty much, you know, he was the grade A mother. I was plan B mother. He's just always been much better at nurturing kids and knowing when they have to be at school and whether it's dress up day or not dress up day, all those things that I'm absolutely useless at. He loves cooking. He kind of, so thanks to his support, because, you know, he's so awesome at that, I could, you know, step back from that, and because it is pretty full on. And, you know, at one point I was doing private practice midwifery, do my PhD, and also doing sessional tutoring at the university. And then I ended up getting a job at the university. And then I ended up a full-time job at the university. So I had, you know, I was a full-time lecturer, private practice, and doing my PhD.
Still doing private practice and all that.
Yeah. And also doing, working for CAPERS, doing workshops and events around Australia, teaching mostly obstetric emergency skills, like for home birth settings, and various workshops. And yeah, so I'm not surprised I kind of burned out.
Yeah. Style. Yeah. So what made you say, okay, I have to not do birth?
It was the kind of big burnout, as I call it, where everything just kind of was just, you know, you have that. It was like before I'd finished my PhD, actually, that I had the big, right, something's got to give, because this I can't, I've burned out my adrenals. You know, I was like, I wasn't well because I was just so frazzled. So I knew that something had to give, and it was a case of, all right, what can I let go of? And I didn't want to let go of any of it because I enjoyed all of it. That's why I was doing it, you know? And in the end, there was all this regulation around private practice midwives that was happening at the same time, because previously all I'd had to regulate me was my registration board, which was simple because you just have to make sure that you're competent, that you're practicing legally, that you're doing, you know, you're ensuring that you're doing evidence-based practice. It was really easy to meet those standards. And if anything arose, then that would be what you'd answer to. And then because midwives wanted insurance and wanted more recognition, we ended up getting ourselves really entangled into the regulation of, well, if you're going to be a private practice midwife, you have to have this particular insurance, and to get that insurance, you need to have done this pharmaceutical course, and you need to be able to prescribe. And it's like, well, I don't want to prescribe, because if a woman needs medication, then she needs to see a medical doctor because I'm a midwife. So it's just getting really difficult to carry on. So that was the obvious thing to drop. And also, you know, I thought, there are lots of amazing midwives, even locally. You know, women can get midwifery support, really good midwifery support, without me. They don't need that. But there's not a lot of midwives who are prepared to engage into the academic learning teaching space and influence that area. So
very wise.
So I decided to drop the practice and move into academia.
Yeah. That was very wise of you. Very insightful. Did you get your PhD in? Or what was your project?
So my project started out looking at what midwives do during what I was calling at that time the second stage of labor. And as with all good research and PhDs, you end up going all over the place and going deeper than you ever thought you'd go, and then coming out with findings that you never thought you'd find. So the thesis ended up being about midwifery practice. Now I'm going to have to try and remember the title now. Midwifery practice, midwifery practice, rites of passage and rites of protection. So it was looking at what midwives do from a kind of perspective of birth as a rite of passage. So there isn't stages. This is a, you know, a holistic, significant rite of passage in a woman's life. And what the midwife does and says around her influences that rite of passage and transmits to the woman what is important within that culture. So as midwives, we're like busy transmitting all these messages that we're unaware of often. So it was really looking at that.
Please tell me you wrote a book about that.
I have written a book, and it's will be published in probably March by the time I've done all the public. So yeah, so that was
awesome.
I did my PhD in 2013 and then said, that's it. I'm bored with this. I'm never going to do this again. I'm sick of it. And kept getting asked to speak about it at conferences. So, you know, usually you do a PhD and then, or a study, and you get asked to, you talk about it after you finished it, and then you move on to the next thing. So I kept trying to move on to the next thing, and it kept coming with me. And, you know, people would ask me to speak at conferences, and I'd say, yeah, well, what do you want me to speak about? Do you want me to speak about this bit of research that I'm doing, or that? Or can you talk about rites of passage? So I just kept getting asked to do it. So I kept doing it. And then I kind of came back to it and kind of not fell in love with it again, but went, do you know what? This is important. And it is a different way of looking at everything. And if I look at it, it's changed all of the research I've done. All of the teaching is underpinned by this. So I actually need to acknowledge it and not keep running away from it.
I think that's amazing. Are you still being asked to speak about that often?
Yeah. And actually it comes into everything that I teach. So for example, I use it as a framework to understand birth and to understand midwifery practice in all factions. So in the Bachelor Midwifery program that I now am program leader for at the university, which we developed, wrote and implemented. So that was exciting, actually writing and implementing a Bachelor of Midwifery program in Australia.
Yeah.
Alongside a fabulous team. So we actually have a Bachelor of Midwifery program, and that's how I teach about the physiology of labor, is using the rites of passage framework. So instead of going stages, because stages is actually a completely made up medical construct that doesn't make any sense in any way, and there's lots of research saying it's rubbish. So instead we look at childbirth as a rite of passage, and for each kind of phase of that rite of passage we look at what the needs of the woman are, what's happening for her on this journey, and then what's happening physiologically, what's happening in her body, and how are the hormones changing, what's going on, you know, in her cervix and her uterus for the baby, and then how can we as midwives promote and support that? And then also the rites of protection, which are about, you know, because birth is dangerous to some extent. How can we enact rites of protection that reinforce the woman as the expert still, but actually also, you know, we act when we need to, you know, if there's an emergency, that's the midwife's role, is to manage that emergency. So how can we weave that into also promoting and supporting the woman as the expert in her own rite of passage?
I cannot wait to read your book. I imagine it's very powerful.
Well, it's kind of my, because when I wrote my PhD thesis, people actually read my thesis, which is very odd, because like, why would you read a PhD thesis? I'm sure they skipped the methodology chapter because they're always boring. And people kept saying, are you going to write this as a book? And I'm like, well, not really, because it's a PhD thesis and it's written like that and it's a bit boring. And I've kind of moved, I've developed that, the whole kind of theory since then, through practice and through teaching and etc. So no, I'm not. And I kept saying, I'm not writing a book. And then, yeah, here I am writing. Everything I say I'm not going to do, I end up doing. So I actually got asked to write the Induction of Labour book by a publisher. So I did that. And so I almost feel like that was that was given to me, or that offered me the opportunity to learn how to write a book, because I've written blogs, I've written journal articles, but I'd written book chapters, but I hadn't written a book. So this Induction of Labour book allowed me to write a book and go through that process.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so then this next book is actually, I feel like it's all of my work. It's so much harder to write than the Induction of Labour book. The Induction of Labour book, Why Induction Matters, was just really getting women's voices who had experienced various things, getting the research, and then creating this kind of story around it to make it understandable. This book was just like, oh, honestly, it was like a labor. I felt like it was all of my PhD, all of my practice as a midwife, all of my teaching pulled together into a book. And it was a lot of history as well, which was not new to me, but certainly, you know, I need to make sure that what I'm writing is correctly cited, and that it's you know, well researched. So it sent me off down the whole rabbit warren of researching history in order to place that at the front, so we can understand what practices we're doing now. So then for each phase, for example, emergence, which is the phase where the woman pushes the baby out, the chapter is the physiology of that, which is told through Eve's story. So we follow Eve's story, which is just the physiology, what's happening in the woman's body and hormonally, physically. And then the next part of so each chapter has Eve's story, and then has a section on what's the core element that's happening for the woman here. And for women, this is the time that they witness their body wisdom, because they've kind of come back from that really liminal altered state, and they've had a boost of adrenaline, which kind of brings them back to that neocortex functioning slightly. So they're often almost observing their body just pushing this baby out, and it's whoa. And then I look at the rites of passage, so how midwives and doulas, care providers, promote and support what's happening for the woman. So what are the actions and things that we do around that? But I look at history. So what's our historical context of that? What have we done since history? What does history tell us about what women need at that time, and what care providers have done? And then what are we doing? And then I look at the rights of protection in terms of, you know, and often the rights of protection in a modern maternity system often utterly conflict with the rites of passage. So, you know, they're contradictory. So on the one hand, we're saying to women, trust your body, you know how to do this. And then on the other hand, we're telling them how to push, you know, chin on your chest, hold your breath and push. Well, either she knows what she's doing or she doesn't. So it's just looking at exploring those kind of practice issues.
So let me ask your expert opinion, especially since you've written a book about induction and then writing a book about this. If you're in a situation that we all are in, like a woman has an epidural, she's getting an induction for whatever reason. And oftentimes you know, they can't necessarily feel to push, and it's much more directed. So you're going to contradict yourself, oh, your body knows what's doing, because you're, so that's my question. What do you do? Yeah. How do you deal with that?
No. So I've been very clear, and I think this is an issue that midwifery has in general, mm-hmm. is this inability, because we're so enmeshed with medical birth that we can't see the difference anymore. And we start to apply principles across, you know, from medical birth into physiology, from physiology into medical. So I've been very careful with this book to be really clear. So part one is kind of the background, the her story and the legacy, and, you know, really putting rites of passage into context. Part two is a journey through a physiological birth. So it is just physiology and how to promote and support that. And then the last chapter is medical birth, because it's different and you need absolutely different approaches. You can't provide the same care and approach to a woman who's being induced with an epidural as you would with a woman who's having a spontaneous physiological birth. It won't work. It's not safe, because it's totally different. Mm-hmm. So in that chapter, I kind of go revisit. So we've done the physiology. So we've looked at what happens if it's And I don't like the word natural because natural includes death and complication. And so what happens during a physiological birth and how do we practice around that to promote and support that? And then medical birthrights is the final chapter, and it's all right. So what about medicine? Because most women don't have that kind of birth. So how can we adapt what we know about physiology for medical birth? You know, how can we ensure that during that emergence phase, when the woman is pushing her baby out, if she has an epidural, she might need some direction. So how can we give that direction and still place her as the expert? And it's around the words that we use and how we do it, you know, instead mm-hmm. of going, right, this is how we're going to do it. Put your chin on your chest, pull your legs up and push into your bottom. It's working with the woman and saying, for example, what sensations can you feel? Because often women can feel something, can't they? So then you reinforce, okay, well, listen to that. You know, you can feel that. That's a contraction. So when you get the contraction, try pushing into that, you know, with that sensation, see what happens. And really engaging her in that process instead of taking it over. So it's about how can we look at every aspect of our practice, whether or not it's supporting physiology or whether or not it's a medical birth. And how can we ensure that the woman, the messages that we transmit continue to be that the woman is, this is her rite of passage and that she's the expert. And it's not about not doing medical things. You know, you have to have a fetal monitoring on if you've got a Syntocin on. It's unsafe not to. That's a really important rite of protection for the baby and mother to monitor an induced labor. So how can we do that in a way that centers the mother? Mm-hmm. So that's what that chapter is about.
Because I feel like that should be required reading for everybody.
Because it's not as simple as right now, it's a medical birth, so now we're taking over. That's not, it's not. What you're doing is you're working with a woman using your expertise and medicine and technology to ensure that her rite of passage remains centered on her and is safe, you know, so that her and her baby are safe and that she comes out of that going, that I led that, I made those decisions, I was involved, you know, all the way along in that birth.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine that you probably talk about with wording and things like that when you're talking about consent, like, yes, you should have an induction of labor and this is why, here's the options of how we could proceed, right?
Yeah, it's about recommending, so saying, mm-hmm. You know, when it comes to words are really, really powerful and also really difficult to get right. You know, how do you share with a woman? So I tend to use the word offer when it's something like gestational diabetic testing and it's just a routine thing. It's, look, this test's offered at this point. This is why it's offered. These are the risks and benefits of it. What do you want to do? I'll support you either way. I always add that in. I'll support you either way so that they know that, you know, it's their decision. But when it comes to something that's more high risk, so for example, a woman with preeclampsia, then it turns into a recommendation. You know, you're still not saying you have to, you're saying, look, it's strongly recommended that we induce the labor because blah, blah, you know, the risks mm-hmm. of not doing so, the benefits of, and the risks of doing so, because there's still risks, but, you know, really discussing that with the woman so that it's a recommendation. And again, saying, you know, although I'm recommending this, I'll support you in your decision. Most women will say, I'll have an induction. You know, sometimes right. They don't, but then that is their responsibility, you know, and then it comes down to you as the midwife ensuring that you've documented the discussions, that you have covered your own back, I guess, in order to support that woman in her decisions, whether you agree with them or not.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you, in your experience with many practitioners and being in two different countries, my experience here is that if women decline, it's very upsetting, not necessarily as much to midwives, but sometimes, but especially to OBs, it's very upsetting, you know, as if it's offensive to them that the woman would not do that or person. So, like, how do you get that across to, I mean, you're teaching students, so hopefully you're teaching them at that level. But how would you say get that across to people, like, you know, consent them appropriately? It's their decision. You can't bear that burden. Right? Yeah, does that make sense?
That's not your, yeah, absolutely. And it's not your problem how somebody else responds to the woman's decision. And it's, And it's also about, you know, it's about communicating strongly and effectively for that woman. So, for example, you know, if you're looking after a woman and she's declined a vaginal examination, for example, which is absolutely, you know, a very valid thing to do. But, you know, there's, if you're working in a hospital system in, not necessarily in the UK, because they didn't even know about women who were low risk, but in Australia and probably in the US, you've got obstetricians outside wanting to know the number. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the woman says no, and you've offered it in, you know, in this hospital, we offer vaginal examinations every 4 hours. They're not evidence-based. Mm-hmm. It's just a cultural norm here and blah, blah, blah. She's done all of that. She said no, you go out and you don't, you shield her. Your job is to actually shield her from that obstetrician. And obstetricians generally are actually all right once they don't have to have the responsibility. Once you pick up a bit of that responsibility and the woman has it, they will often back off. So, you know, you say, all right, so I've offered the vaginal examination to this woman. She's declined the vaginal examination. She's made an informed decision. I've documented that. I think the labor is progressing really well because of blah, blah, blah. I mean, as midwives, I'm doing some research into this at the moment with another fabulous academic midwife, looking at how midwives assess labor. We all know we don't just look at cervixes. You know, you use it. So you say, you know, I'm seeing this. Baby's well, mother's well. I will keep you informed if there's any concerns. So you kind of, you haven't said, please come in and say anything. You said, I will come out and tell you if there's any concerns. Mm-hmm. So you've now taken ownership of that. So if you don't tell them, you've messed up.
Yeah.
So that's how I would recommend.
In the US, it's not happened to me personally, but I know that it happens. It can feel intimidating. For example, like, there are many places that don't even have midwives. So it's a nurse with an obstetrician. And then that nurse has been verbally demeaned or insulted or assaulted by the obstetrician. And so there's fear in standing up for that mother, or they just don't do it at all. I mean, you have a brand new, you know, 24-year-old nurse. She's not going to say anything to an obstetrician that's been doing this for 20 years or whatever. So that's scary, at least for us. But I think that language that you suggested would be very helpful, because as you said, it takes that ownership. It's just, it is, she said, no, this is, you know, but it can be scary.
Oh, it absolutely can. And you kind of, we, on the Midwives Cauldron, actually, this is pretty much a lot of our episodes are about this stuff. We've just done a two-parter looking at working, navigating the system, which is about this stuff, because we keep getting questions, but what, you know, how can I do this? Blah, blah, blah. If I do this, then that. And so there are, we talk about ways of doing it, including language and how to approach it, but also to remember, you know, this is, it's not up to students and new grads to lead the revolution. It's not. So, you know, I talk about sphere of influence, and Katie says that I said fear of influence. And now we've got a whole running thing on the podcast where she calls it the fear of influence. I call it the sphere of influence. That you look at what it is that you can do. Now, as a new grad or a student, you're probably not going to have the confidence to go out and say, this woman said this, and you're not coming in the room. Yeah. And that's fine. It's not actually your job to do that. It's great if you can. If you can't, that's not your job. But you know, these more experienced midwives, particularly the older, more experienced midwives who can, should, you know. And I think we really forget that midwifery is about being with women. That is the core of it. And whether or not we are working alongside other colleagues, essentially what we should be doing is working for woman and for women in general, advocating for women in general, but also for that individual woman. And that sometimes means that you don't have friends in your workplace, you know, that people don't like you. And that's really hard, particularly because it's mostly women who are in birth work, and we're socialized to want to accommodate and be nice and be seen to be good girls. So we play into that, you know, and obstetricians actually increasingly are female, but the power dynamic is still there. So we still want to belong and to be liked. And sometimes we have to make the decision that I'd rather not be liked, but feel, you know, aligned in who I am and how I'm practicing, and find those few people who get me and who work like me, and just release the attachment to what those people think of me. And that's kind of what I realized a long time ago, that the shifts that I walked home from in tears were not necessarily the shifts where a woman had had a massive hemorrhage or there'd been some, you know, emergency situation. It had been the shifts where I had been complicit and had not spoken out and watched a woman have a vaginal examination against her wishes, or watched her be coerced without saying anything. Those were the shifts that I left crying. So I kind of made the decision, right, I'm not going to do that. What's more important is that, you know, I'm working in a way that I know is aligned with who I am and is best for the for this woman, rather than, you know, perhaps having lots of friends.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure if you ask people that I worked with, a lot of people didn't like me.
But now you have such great insight in that you're sharing with the next generation. So hopefully it was worth it, not being liked.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see. It's really hard because I know what they're going out into, you know. Yeah. So you're teaching them about evidence and physiology and, you know, this identity as a midwife who advocates for women and is, you know, confident in her abilities. And then you just know that they go out and they get slammed a lot of the time, mm-hmm. you know, and it's trying to support them through to get them to the place where they can affect change. Because when you're a student, you can't, and they're seeing things and they're powerless. And how do you support them to keep going so that they come out the other end and then gain some confidence and some power? Because it's really demoralizing, you know, particularly when, you know, midwives don't, never mind students, don't understand the distinction between physiology and not physiology, because they don't see physiology ever. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you hear them talking about a natural birth and then they're talking about an induction. It's like, no.
How is the midwife community there? Are they welcoming to new grads, or is it eat your young type of culture?
Oh, I think it very much depends, doesn't it, on the culture of the organization. So it depends where the students end up.
Okay.
I think actually, I'm trying to think about it. New grads tend to be fair better than students, because I think in what I also noticed in Australia is having a student as a midwife working in a hospital, having a student working alongside you is seen as an additional burden, not mm-hmm. not as just part of the job, and actually quite good because they can do some of the work. So I think they cop a lot of this. It's starting to change, but they do cop that when they're students. I think once they're grads, they're seen as more valuable. So I think there's a bit of a shift in that you're now one of us and you're now valuable.
Yeah, I think there's some of that here, but probably a mixture. Like you said, depending on where you're at and who you're with. I think you've shared so much. I won't keep you on here any longer. You probably have a work day to get to.
Have you yakked for long enough?
I know, but it was such a pleasure. Sure. I can't wait to share this. Say the name of your book again and when we should expect it.
Oh, it's called Reclaiming Childbirth as a Rite of Passage.
Okay.
And it will be out in March. So if people just look for Midwife Thinking or Rachel Reed, I've got a website and on my blog, Midwife Thinking, there's mm-hmm. links where you can go and find out more. And if you follow me on social media, then I will announce when it's up and running.
And what's your social media handle?
Midwife Thinking.
Okay. I know what it is, but I'd like you to say it and I'll link it. And then
Midwife Thinking.
Everyone needs to go listen to your two-part episode you were just talking about.
Yeah. If you go and listen to Navigating the System, because that's all about how do we survive as midwives working in a system that's not set up for women or for midwives.
Yeah. I should have listened to that before I talked to you.
You can go and listen to it now.
I'm going to. Well, all right, Rachel, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Well, podcast family, I hope you loved that episode with Dr. Rachel Reed as much as I enjoyed talking to her. She has a brilliant mind, and I could probably just spend hours listening to her. So if you feel the same way I do, hop on over to her podcast at Midwife's Cauldron, and I'm certain you will love it. And check out her blog at midwifethinking.com. And again, she's on Instagram at midwifethinking. And if you want to find me, I'm on Instagram at Journey to Midwifery Podcast. And you can also email me at journeytomidwiferypodcast@gmail.com. If you want to be a guest on the podcast, I would love to have you. Until next time.